MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
My next guest says there are huge profits to be made in exploiting South Africa's natural resources, but they do come at a cost to society and the environment. Patrick Bond is Distinguished Professor at the University of Johannesburg's Department of Sociology, where he directs the Center for Social Change. Professor Bond, welcome to you. And firstly, then, why have you seen fit to raise this issue? And what advice are you giving to the new Environment Minister?
Oh, it's very nice to be with you and the listener, Jeremy. Probably not sounding a warning so much as retaining caution that an approach that Dion George's predecessor, Barbara Creasy, had adopted that didn't work. And that approach relies upon essentially the market system and technology to solve these vast socio-ecological and especially biodiversity and climate catastrophes that are unfolding. We're in a sixth great extinction. And as even indications such as the flooding in Cape Town or the rain bomb that hit Durban, we're really unprepared for extreme weather events. That's why I think the caution about whether the markets and technology come to the rescue is really appropriate, especially because Dion George is in China at the moment and he's adopting the BRICS policies in spite of DA opposition to some of the BRICS. They're working hand in glove with the Brazil, South Africa, India, China delegation to do exactly that, markets and technology as solutions instead of climate justice.
How does any government these days find the right balance between societal need on the one side and also responsible environmental and climate management?
Well, there's really four approaches, and the one that we're obviously worried about in terms of balance is a complete lack of balance, which is Donald Trump and climate denialism, and that appears very much to be ascendant, and there are plenty of other right-wing governments around the world that are basically turning away. A second approach, which I think Dion George and Barbara Creasy have adopted, is to adopt, let's say, a corporate agenda of new gas and, to some extent, oil, and potentially including some further development of South Africa's coal resources, but then to pretend that there are techniques in place to mitigate against the impact. The third is to actually go full carbon pricing and to use taxation to stop as many emissions as we can that are irrational and counter to the national and the continental and the world's interests. And the fourth is the climate justice, which suggests we should be turning away from both market and technology and really imposing through state will, as was done with the chlorofluorocarbons that were threatening the ozone hole, really impose emissions cuts and to do so with an equity lens, that is to make sure that women, low-income communities, people of color are not going to bear the burden since they, by and large, didn't cause the problem. So those four ideologies, hopefully we won't see Donald Trump in the White House, but with Biden stepping down, maybe things have changed in the calculus there. But there is certainly a climate denialism as witnessed in the hosting of this event, not only this year in Azerbaijan, oil petrostate, right? But also last year in the UAE, the year before in Egypt. And then we have, I think, where unfortunately Dion George has locked in. I was surprised, actually, that he's really uncritically adopted this sort of BRICS position, which is let the middle income or sub-imperial countries continue emitting as much as they like. He's made that very clear in his statement to the BASIC conference in Wuhan, China.
Professor Bond, let's pivot, if we can, from politics and policy maybe just to real impact. And how then do pollution and greenhouse gas emissions, as you've raised, disproportionately impact black and low-income communities in South Africa? Where specifically? And do you think it's getting worse?
Oh, absolutely. And anyone who witnessed the extraordinary rain, let me call them grenades, they kept hitting over the past week and a half in Cape Town and the Cape Flats. You know, the DA there running the city will probably say with some justification, yeah, but some of those houses that were flooded, the shacks, were basically the result of the COVID-19 land invasions. Do you remember in mid-2020 with a failure by national government to enforce the prohibition on evictions? There were plenty of evictions in townships, in Khayelitsha especially. Then there were something like 200 land invasions. And in those low-lying areas or in areas near rivers, or in the case of Durban in 2022, many shacks that climb up those rather steep hills, well, they become very vulnerable when there's terrible rain, and the 500 people who died in Durban and the surrounds in April 12, 2022, 497, I only could find in all my research there, only three white middle-income fatalities. Every fatality is tragic, but it definitely is the case that on the question of flooding, our lack of stormwater drainage for low-income areas, the lack of decent housing, the bridges and roads that collapse, these reflect a failure to make our cities resilient. And then, of course, the rural areas are subject to the droughts. And in our case, a little bit, a couple of years ago, locust plagues. And that really has hit East Africa. I was in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam last week, and they were, especially Nairobi, if you go all the way out to Somalia, you find devastation in droughts. And then when the droughts end and there's flooding, also the locusts come and they ripped up the food system. So rural Africa definitely needs some adaptation in the form of better irrigation and food sovereignty instead of the cash cropping that's mostly what we do with agriculture in the continent.
Isn't economic development always, though, detrimentally going to impact environmental protection?
Yes, if we call it development, I would call it maldevelopment, Jeremy. And, you know, we're sitting here, you and I in Johannesburg, we're the epitome, aren't we? The world's most unequal city. And if you think back roughly 100 years, we were the city that had at peak half the world's gold reserves underneath us. And now what have we got? Zamazamas and big holes and acid mine drainage and all sorts of problems that have come from the simple draining. Instead of having reinvested, let's say the way Norway, which has vast amounts of oil, and about 30 years ago, they set up their oil fund to reinvest, a sort of sovereign wealth fund, and they take the proceeds and put them back into future generations' interests, whether that be education or financial assets that will grow over time or productive assets. And we've just simply not done that, have we? Most of our wealth from that vast amount of gold has frittered away or gone to London or to tax havens. And I think that's the essence of where Dion George has, I think, ultimately failed with an ideology that says, as he actually put it, I see through the lens of finance. And yet, as readers can do, because it's online, you can find his UNISA PhD on change, environmental change. There's nothing about natural environment. There's no attempt in his work to understand market failures, financial speculation bubbling, and the looting of our continent through resource depletion. That's really the worst aspect to me, Jeremy, of living in an Africa that is extraordinarily wealthy. We have $10 trillion dollars worth, $185 trillion in assets in natural resources still underground. But at this rate, when we're basically taking it out of the country and we're failing to find the reinvestment in higher education and other education that is human capital and also productive capital. Our fixed investment rate is very low. That means our depletion of natural capital is devastating. So that's where I'd hoped to find Dion George, let me call him a financially conscious in the biggest sense that our resources include our natural resources. But I simply don't see that. And regrettably, as he's gone to China to do advocacy alongside Brazil, India, China, the basic group within the United Nations, he's basically locked into their agenda, which is to keep emitting and to never admit any climate debt, any ecological reparations that are due. So I'm, you know, already as disappointed as I projected in writing about this in the conversation which you've posted on MoneyWeb today. Thanks.
Professor Patrick Bond, thank you very much indeed.